Welcome to the Logan Bartlett Show. I am your host, Logan Bartlett, and what you're going to hear on this episode is a conversation I had with Zach Weinberg. Zach is the co-founder of CuriBio, which is trying to build the YC for biotech. Before that, he was the co-founder of Flatiron, which sold to Roche in a multi-billion dollar outcome. And before that, he was the co-founder of Invite Media, which sold to Google shortly after Zach graduated from college. He also runs his own venture firm called Operator Partners, where he, along with his longtime business partner, Nat Turner, make investments in companies in healthcare and in software. This is a wide-ranging conversation on markets, where we talk about what we're seeing in the venture landscape, what's going on with down rounds, fund sizes, artificial intelligence, some principles around operating in a remote world, among a bunch of different things. Zach's always a pleasure to have on, and nothing short on his opinions as well. And so hopefully you enjoy this discussion now with Zach. If you are enjoying the content that we're putting out there, please do like, share, subscribe. Every little bit helps, particularly on YouTube. We're trying to grow that platform more and more. And so if you could subscribe to our YouTube channel and like the content that we're posting, we'd really appreciate it. It really helps spread the word for us. So now, without further ado, Mr. Zach Weinberg.
I feel like I'm dressed for a tennis game. We have a NASDAQ closing bell ceremony we're doing this afternoon. And so this is my my summer business casual attire. This is what you're getting from me.
What's the closing bell ceremony? What is that?
We launched today some infrastructure index. So you can track different infrastructure companies as an index. And so a bunch of the companies that are on it are coming and doing a ceremony. And then we came out with a private company list of, I think, 100 companies on the list of like different stages, early, mid, and growth of these businesses, kind of private infrastructure companies. And so, so everyone's in town for it. We're going to go clap and do the bell ceremony thing and then do the NASDAQ billboard thing and all of that. So it should be good.
Where's the dinner? I assume there's a dinner.
Right? Zuzu. Have you been there?
No, but I heard it's great.
It's good. Yeah. It's not too far from you, I guess. I mean, it's in that Hudson Yards thing. Hudson Yards, did you see the, I think it was New York Times or Wall Street Journal. It seems like it's maybe not working out.
Now they're having trouble with it's a lot of commercial space, right? Like they built a ton of office buildings. So I assume whatever they underwrote the square footage price at.
But it seems like the residential is struggling too, which is interesting. I guess why would you live there? It's kind of the price point is high and there's not like bones or architecture of like getting New York. And so I get if you're working in Hudson Yards, why you would live there, but it's kind of like it might as well be in Dallas, Texas, or, you know, Charlotte, North Carolina, or a high rise in Miami or something. Like it's not, you're not really living in New York, right?
Yeah, I guess like access to the tunnel.
Totally. Practically, it makes sense. Like if you're on the West Side Highway, it totally, if your office is over there, you can get to Newark Airport pretty easily. Like I get logistically why you do it. It just doesn't shock me that the occupancy, if they're trying to charge $4,000, $5,000 for like a 600 square foot bedroom or something, like I get why that value prop isn't going to resonate with a lot of people that want some element of New York, even if it is shitty walk ups or whatever.
Yeah. The restaurants are really, they've gotten pretty good, but the neighborhood, you know, you feel like you're in the Mall of America.
Yeah. I mean, it literally could be in any city that you do some big development area over there. So it's not like it's a unique, it doesn't feel uniquely New York in any way.
And then also like north of it sucks.
Yes. Hell's Kitchen.
And then there's, you know, it's not even really Hell's Kitchen. Like as you get north, there's like a 9-block gap between.
They tried to name it like a decade ago, probably when you were first moving into the city. I think they tried to call it MIMA or something, like Middle Manhattan. And obviously that didn't exactly take off. But you're right. Like Hudson Yards stops at what, 38th or something?
I think even closer to like 35th or whatever. It's like not, there's a, you know, the real like Hell's Kitchen area is kind of like high 40s, low 50s almost. There's like a weird gap. And then south of it too, you're kind of in like Northwest Chelsea, which is like the not the nicest part of Chelsea, basically. So you're, you know, you're sandwiched between stuff that's not super interesting to walk to,
basically. Yeah.
I wonder, that to me is always COVID. New York. If you can walk, you want to walk to stuff, right? Like, totally. It's the whole fucking point, you know?
So. And it's so far away. The subway stop doesn't exactly fix it, but like going, I'm on the Lower East Side, and getting from Hudson Yards to my place, it's just like, it's really far. And you really, you forget how far west being on whatever 11th Ave or on the West Side Highway, how far west that is to get to the East Village or, God forbid, Brooklyn. Or if you need to fly to JFK or LaGuardia, like it's really far away, right? Especially if you catch it at any point of traffic getting cross town. You'll spend as much time getting cross town as you will getting, like, once you're out of the city to the airport.
Yeah. No, New York needs like a zip line from like Hudson Yards to like Bowery.
I like that. Yeah.
That would do it, actually. That's like kind of, even for me, I'm in Chelsea, kind of like East Chelsea, I guess, on between 6th and 7th. And like for me to get to the East Village is a pain in the ass.
Is it Governor's Island or Roosevelt Island that has like the little gondolas that you can go out to?
Roosevelt.
Yeah. I would be down for that, like gondolas going cross city. I mean, theoretically, subways should solve this problem, but I don't know.
Gondolas. Yeah, New York never built that like cross cutting. You know, it just doesn't, because it was really built to kind of like cut down to get to Brooklyn, as opposed to like all the way for whatever reason. You know, the L is like the only effective crosstown subway, and it's 14th Street. Zip.
What are you guys doing now? So last we spoke, you were you had publicly launched your Curie bio, which I
Curie.
God damn,
like Marie Curie.
I know who it's named after. I can't say it right. Anytime I try to say it, I say it differently. But so you launched that. Are you guys going into an office?
We have a little bit of a unique setup that I think, if I were running, frankly, any startup, and I don't think it has to just be what we're doing in biotech, but almost any startup where you don't have like a physical manufacturing type work that you need to do. So for like software, obviously, and anything adjacent. So we have work from home is the primary, meaning like we assume you're working from home day to day. We don't hire you based on where you are, like where you live. And then every 6 weeks we meet in Boston, which is where most people are, for roughly 4 days. Sometimes some people stay for the whole week, but basically Monday to Thursday, every 6 weeks. And we do it where it's pre-scheduled for basically the whole year. Like we have all the 2024 dates already scheduled. So people know, you can plan ahead.
It's like board meetings-ish.
It's more frequent than people were used to doing. A lot of times people will do it like every quarter, every half year or whatnot. So we're doing it every 6 weeks. You get to do about 8 times a year, which is honestly, like, I wish we did a little bit more. And then we'll do some like all hands zoomy stuff in between, but it's pretty often.
Have you calculated the total cost? And I realize it's not just a cost trade-off. It's also like a talent, you know, opening the aperture of talent. But have you calculated, does it end up still being cheaper than having an office space in New York to house the number of people? Or have you not even done that math?
Yeah, we just never did the math. My guess is it's probably the same. Like when you add in all the flights and the hotel and the travel and all that kind of stuff, you know, that frequently versus the reduced footprint you need on the real estate side. So we still have an office in Boston. It's just smaller. So you can go there if you'd like, if you're based in Boston. Then we have a small office in New York City because there's about 6 of us in New York. Those are the only 2 places. And eventually I assume we'll get something in San Francisco, but like the footprint of those are materially smaller than you would normally have, right? For the number of people. I got to think it's a wash. That's my guess.
What about process wise? Have you guys done anything process, like in a purposeful way outside of that, for remote communication or, is it just standard Slack? Have you done the, I saw you tweeting about Rome and what Howard's doing. Like, have you guys done anything interesting from a process standpoint for remote workers?
By far. So a few thoughts. One, like, so we don't even have Slack. Wow. I hate it. And the thing that kind of drives me crazy for Slack, for what we do, I'm not suggesting this would work because like we don't build software. And I think if we were doing a lot more like software design, software execution, Slack would be really useful. I think it's particularly good for like small teams working on engineering. But I felt like Slack had two really big downsides. One is it just becomes like a social tool and it's completely distracting. And so I hated it from that perspective, and I didn't want to have, you know, like the pets channel and stuff. Like, that's not what work is for. And then the other one is that it's so easy to use from like a group discussion standpoint, right? Like, you know, everyone has a group thread, that I felt like a lot of decisions that shouldn't be made in chat were like getting made in chat basically, because, you know, the friction of setting up a live meeting was always pretty high. And so, you know, when you have this like asynchronous or like semi-synchronous group chat going, stuff where you're like, oh, I'll just like type it in the chat. And then whoever's like there to respond, all of a sudden you get these decisions that shouldn't have been done in a chat setting, basically. Like, it should have been in a call or a meeting. So we don't use it. We use WhatsApp, interestingly enough. For everyone has it on their phone. It's not as easy to use, actually, which I think is like a feature, not a bug. I don't know how long we'll last. Like, at some point we may have to get a Slack like thing for this. The biggest gap with like WhatsApp, and I think a lot of these, is just the quick ad hoc audio. Like, that's the thing we've been trying to replicate. It's just really, really difficult. You know, the like after meeting quick discussion that isn't scheduled, the unscheduled meeting. Basically,
I referenced it, but for people that don't know, Howard Lerman was the CEO of Yext, public, whatever, billion-dollar company. And his thing now is, and there were a few of these that tried it during the pandemic where they were a little too gamey. It sort of felt like you were playing Pokemon, where it's like you have your little avatar and then you can go walk over to someone and then a video would pop up and then you can go walk into another. And I think what Howard has done with Rome is like, it's pretty utilitarian in the way that a professional tool should be. But then you can see who's in calls or in meetings in a visual manner. You can drop in on that. You can do one click knock to set up an audio or a visual conversation, right? And so it's cool. One of my companies uses it within their engineering team and they swear by it. They really, really like it. I think Howard's doing like a slow rollout of the number of people that get to use it. It makes sense. I feel like the process stuff with Slack is, it's almost like the standard is synchronous communication. And that is just not the way most decisions, or by interruption, most work should be done, right? And so like, I have certain things that I'm very dogmatic about. Email me about those things. And if someone sends it to me and it's like this detailed thing and I'm coming out of a meeting and I'm trying to catch an Uber, and then I have this fucking essay written out about should we do XYZ thing, the context switching is really hard. And I was listening actually to an interesting podcast. The guy's name here, let me pull it up. The guy's name is Cal Newport. Have you ever heard of this guy? I think he's like a Georgetown professor or something. And he was on Sam Harris talking about, I think he was saying his view is actually that Slack as a tool hasn't led to productivity increase because the context switching of stuff, and like, just it actually ends up degrading our work experience. And I don't know, I feel like it's such a powerful tool that maybe should be used with better process around it in the hybrid environment. Like, hey, these things go in Slack and you our expectations are you respond in 24 hours. These types of things never go in Slack. Like, you need to have your alerts off, right? If whatever. And just like having different expectations set from a process standpoint of how it works, just because it's so, you can do so much with it and the expectations. I even have this of like quick response. I see green light on, get back to me quickly on it, right? And obviously that interrupts people's deep work, which you only have so many hours a day that you can do that stuff.
Yeah, and it's interrupted in chat as opposed to audio, where like on the audio side, you have just like higher fidelity. You can get to the answer a lot faster than typing. And so on the like limited, you know, unscheduled time you have, it feels like not a great use of that limited unscheduled time. There are clearly some things it's particularly useful for, like a small team. Yes, like group chat in a small team, I'm sure is better than like long threaded emails. It's just when it like devolves into whatever else, like, you know, channels with 400 people in them, shit like that. I just felt like it was distracting. So we don't use it at the moment. We're also a small group. We're like 30, 35 people now. So it's not huge. So Rome, by the way, Rome, I think is going to be great. I'm an investor. So
So you're buying. Yeah.
But I've known Howard for a long time, but I think something like that will become the default for many people. We obviously we did the remote thing, not because I cared about like the cost savings, but because the talent, it allows us to just hire kind of like wherever, whenever, you know, somebody is available. The number one thing that, and I didn't plan this, I think we kind of discovered it, is like, okay, if you're remote first, you assume that all the meetings are like Zoom or Teams or whatever. We use Zoom, but like same idea. We record quite a bit of the internal meetings, especially the ones that are the most complex from like a discussion standpoint. So like our investment committee, for example, like all our IC meetings are recorded. And then even some of the like lead up internal meetings we have to the investment committee where we're doing debate on the company itself, that's all recorded. And it goes, we use Grain, which is another company we invested in, but I personally invested in.
We're all shilling stuff. Rome, I'm not investors in, so I just think it's interesting.
I'm two for two here, you know, yeah. Rome and Grain. So we use all the tools I invested in personally. But so with Grain, we record all the meetings and then it goes into essentially like a library of recorded meetings. And so it solves two problems that I really like. One is like, you know, you want to give people exposure to these kind of discussions because it's good training and it's good context. But when there's like 800 fucking little boxes on a Zoom, people's behaviors change in those meetings. And so what this does is it lets us kind of keep the meeting room smaller, but still provide context without them having to be there. So that was really nice.
We have that weird thing with entrepreneurs coming in and pitching where we want to be inclusive and we want to have people in fullness have the expectations of like what's going on in the firm. But then an entrepreneur comes in and we want to feel bespoke and like you get me, if I'm going to invest in you, like it's going to be us, right? And then you have 15 fucking boxes on a screen and it just feels like you're presenting to an auditorium in some ways, I think, as an entrepreneur. So recording is a little interesting on that side. Investment committee, I think, makes sense. Recording an entrepreneur's pitch, I think, puts them in a weird spot a little bit. Hey, we're just going to record this for other people, but I don't know.
I've changed my tune on this quite a bit. The other use case we use it for is onboarding and training, because we basically have like a playlist that we can give somebody in the 2 weeks before they start. And then, you know, when they actually start, I'm like, all right, you want to see like the kind of work that we do and what we're up to, like just go watch all, you know, these 17 videos that we've flagged for you. And they're mostly internal meetings, some external ones. And I think we'll end up recording more and more with the founders over time. As a founder myself, so being on the other side of this, like when we were fundraising for Curie in the first place, like would I have hesitated to have the meeting recorded? Yes. At the same time, like there's so many decision makers inside of these firms that actually just like having the recording of me doing the story might actually be better than the partner I was talking to trying to repeat what I told them and trying to sell it through. So I've like slowly changed my tune. I actually think these recordings can be quite valuable for sharing context within an organization in a way that like, if they're not, what is it like the notes document is doing it? Like, really? That's going to get, I'd rather them like hear it from me personally. Yeah.
It is interesting though. We came from the spectrum. If you talk to the people that were like dogmatically remote first, pre-pandemic. It was like Matt Mullenweg from Automattic or Sid from GitLab or whatever. There were a handful of them. And how purposeful and thoughtful those folks were about stuff. Hey, if you're coming into, if we're going to do a big meeting, everyone needs to be in Zoom. And if we have people, if people are in the same office, we can't have them in the same room together because it changes the dynamic having two people having a conversation in a room while two others are both remote on a screen, which totally makes sense. And then we were forced to drink from a fire hose of like switching to fully remote. And I think people adopted a lot of bad practices, not in a very purposeful way. But it was fine because everyone was remote, like at the peak of the pandemic, right? There weren't two people that were sitting in the same room. And now as we kind of, as we've unwound remote as the standard and move back either to this hybrid thing or just more people are fully remote, I feel like the lessons are being learned from COVID and people are just taking what they did to COVID and going to in person. And now we sort of have this weird hybrid situation where seven people are in the room together and three are on video. And now the three that are on video aren't like tied in with the seven that are in the room, rather than like going back to the first principles that Matt and Sid and whoever else were so purposeful about Zapier. We're so purposeful about like 10 years ago, trying to make everyone on the same page with everything.
Yeah, no, you can't do the like in office plus at home. It just doesn't.
Which, by the way, I think 90% of companies are in some version of that, or 75%. I think a lot of people are still in that-ish mindset right now. And it's hard to unwind it. I'd be interested in your perspective on this. Like, let's say you want to go back to fully in person. I've talked to CEOs, like they want to get back to fully in person and they feel like they made some mistakes over the course of COVID in allowing and hiring people to come in as remote workers, right? Well, how do you get there? Do you tell them over the next 2 years, we're going to transition? And so you make a decision if you want to move or not, and you give them 2 years, 18 months, 6 months, 3 months. Like, what is the right time horizon to tell them that they need to be back? What cost of living adjustment do you do? All of these things. It's like, it's pretty hard to figure out how to put the toothpaste back in the tube.
Depends how competitive you feel from a talent market perspective. Like, are you willing to lose people? And what percentage of those people are you willing to lose? And what percentage of them are actually the really good ones? Like, I don't know. Can you really mandate fully in person for the average company? Like, if you're, I kind of view it as like, there's a lot of things you can ask your employees to do when you pay them a fuck ton of money. Like, you work at a hedge fund, they could be like, you're sleeping in the office for the next 14 days and like, or you're fired. And people will hem and haw. But then when you realize like, oh, right, I make like $4 million a year and the alternative job for me is like nowhere close. Like, yeah, you're going to go sleep in the office and you pay people to do that. And so I think some of these like really high comped hedge funds in particular, yeah, you're going to be in the office because that's what they want. And your alternative is not great. And then I think you can do it in kind of like the other end of the spectrum, actually, in a really weird way, where the employer holds all, like, people want the job, they need the job. And so they're just going to follow whatever the employer needs because, you know, maybe their alternative is not great. These are like lower skilled, but remote type jobs where, you know, again, the power sits with the employer. It's that whole middle that I would actually be really concerned about.
Which is the vast majority of companies are in the middle, right?
Oh, it's probably 95%, yeah. You know, something like that. Yeah.
And by the way, every employee exists on a slightly different perspective on this. If you're co-founder or the VP of Eng that you worked five years to bring on board, and now that person lives in Florida, are you going to create slightly different rules for it? Are you really going to let the VP of Eng walk over this thing? Like, it's hard.
Yeah, they drift. And then, you know, it's like, all right, well, that person who's really, this is the problem. The really good people have choice, right? And you know,
even
that
now in the shitty market, they still have choice.
It's not even that shitty. Unemployment's like 3.whatever%. You know, it's like tiny.
Shitty,
I mean, I know
venture
it's
backed. Venture,
feels
I mean, venture
like
backs
it intact. Yeah, but like if you're really good, you kind of always have choice is the reality. Maybe you don't have the highest end, but you have choice. And like, you could just go get a job with a company that really wants you, that is going to allow you to be remote. And that that specific pressure right there, where like your best people can kind of do what they'd like, is going to be really hard to keep people in the office. So I don't think,
you know, what's interesting is it's your best and also the most fungible. And that's really hard. Let's say you have a bulk group of CS people or something, right? And there's 150 of them. And this isn't ragging on CS people at all, but you're kind of beholden to, we see this in venture all the time about like our associates, especially during the big run-up of the last 2 years, we were kind of beholden to the most flexible optionality that anyone gave, because we were constantly at risk of the entire class, like an entire group of people being like, well, I like this place, but this other place will let me do this and I can go do that. And I think that's true of the jobs that are fairly fungible as well, where you might face just like a mass exodus of EAs or customer support reps or whatever it is. Like, there are a bunch of those jobs that are going to be allowed to be remote as well. And so and weirdly, it's like a barbells, the highest end people and the theoretically most fungible, but losing either is bad, right? In mass, it's really hard to do.
I also think like we talk about in-office time as if it's all created equal, like you just need a certain number of in-office days. And I that's probably not right either. Like, there's a in-office conversations for some specific type of work is really important. I think in particular, like complex planning. And so I don't know. I think people are going to head in the direction, frankly, that we are at Curie. Cause I sat and thought about this for a very, very long time because I had a blank slate, right? I'd seen the in-person thing for my whole career. Even Flatiron previously was like a heavy in-person New York culture. And so, and we had some remote, but I think in office is going to be planned, and not just like which days you're going to be there, but actually the agenda. Like, we're in office for this reason. We're debating, you know, whatever next quarter's goals or this spec or something along those lines. And it's pre-scheduled and there's clear agendas and there's like action items and takeaways and all that. It's not like, oh, I'll be there on Tuesday. It's like, no. The whole team is coming in this week. That kind of thing.
And I'll say this black and white, and obviously it's not, but like if you're an IC, the more IC-ish job you have, engineering and sales in particular, where there's like objective measures of your performance. Now, sales ramp is hard. And oftentimes you need like very specific metrics to measure that and figure it out and all that. But like there's ways of doing that. And so if you're an IC salesperson, one, you're very self-contained in a lot of the things you're doing. And performance is very trackable in a lot of ways, right? Engineering, you're very self-contained in a lot of ways of what you're doing. It's harder to measure performance, but those jobs are so desirable and the people so scarce that like you're a little more beholden to the circumstances around it. There's the more collaborative jobs that exist where it actually involves strategic planning and coordination and oftentimes whiteboarding. And I think about like marketing or product or, you know, executive team meetings and all of that. And like, there is the benefit of just like short circuiting a lot of the stuff by being in person. And then there's this whole other bucket that's like culture and just the depth of relationship you're building with your colleagues. Because at the end of the day, I feel like especially our generation, the millennial generation on down, grew up in the time at which the white picket fence, we saw our parents as boomers pursue their job as a means to an end of having this great life. And then a lot of us saw all of that shit unwind in 2008, where they're like, oh shit, they bought this big house and now they're underwater and their life savings were tied up in it. Now they can't sell it and all that. And so I think there's a lot of people that are like disillusioned a little bit with work as a only means of how they find fulfillment or at least the monetary value of it. And so I think those people, like the culture, especially when you're younger, is like a super important thing. And so it's kind of like, to what end are you having these in-person office things?
I think it's just going to be you know, remote first will win for most of these companies over the long period because of talent and talent alone, not because it's better, not because, like, you know, it's more effective or anything along those lines. Like, maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but just because the best people, which are what you need, are going to demand it because they want the flexibility and they can. And so remote first will win most of the, let's call it most of the time, as like the best talent realizes they have the leverage. And then you're going to have to back into like the things that you do need in person for, right? You need it for debate. You need it for some culture building. You need it for training in many cases. And that's why I think we end up with this hybrid where the in-person is almost offsite kind of in-persons. It's just way more frequent than I think people currently do it.
The recording thing is interesting, by the way, that you're doing that. I've always thought there was a company, MindTickle, that was like sales enablement for video dissemination. And so, Zach, if you had a bunch of enterprise sales reps, you could record the pitch of, hey, here's how I would articulate the battle card against our number one competitor. And as it changes, it would get pushed out almost like many TikTok or YouTube videos that like sales reps could watch 90 seconds of the founder actually saying it. And I think video recording and LMS related stuff is underutilized, particularly now in this world where we have a camera on us for so much, right? There's so much fidelity of information that happens in these meetings, and you don't have to go full Bridgewater, like everything's recorded. But I do think training is a really interesting point.
Training, even just like documentation of decision making. Like if you do the five why, you know, there's so many things that you can improve on when you have like the source data and it's not somebody's notes in a meeting or some remote, you know, it's just like, all right, let's just go pull up the video and like see what happened. The other thing we started learning with this stuff with the recordings, especially when we were early at Curiate, not that we're not like, we've been around for like a year and a half, whatever, but really in the beginning, you know, we would be having debates about how to position the business or pricing or something like that. And usually there's somebody there like taking notes, and that person really can't participate as well in the meeting because their brain is in like note taking land. And then what I realized, like, oh shit, I really don't have to take notes in all of this. I'd rather just have like the debate. And then when somebody on the team says something really interesting or smart or whatever in Grain, you can just like click one button and it flags it. You know, it's like a bookmark. And then afterwards you can go back and pull the video and you have the transcription. You can turn it into like the slide that you need to make. It's really kind of amazing if you lean into like everything's recorded, or at least most important things are recorded. So that's my guess. I think we're heading in a world where recording is the default, where tracking people's work when they're at home becomes the default. Like the Big Brother thing is actually, we're going to head more Big Brother than I think people realize, because, you know, if you're remote first, like, okay, well, what are you working on? What are you spending your time on? All of a sudden those become like pretty reasonable questions for an employer to be asking because they can't see you, right? They don't know. So I think we're going to shift a little bit to maybe, you know, the eye of Sauron, if you will, of like employers. But that's the trade, right? Like that's the trade. If you want to be able to work in your pajamas, like I have sandals. I don't think I put shoes on for like 5 days, you know, like that's what you're going to have to make the trade for. And I think people are going to do it. It's really lifestyle wise. I think the work from home stuff is materially better, but it's not like we're living in cities is getting cheaper, right? It's getting more expensive. You know, the housing costs are going up for in every major city. So especially for people that are starting families and they want more space, like that trade's going to win. The more space in the burbs is going to win. So I don't know. It'll be interesting.
I've been trying to get you to opine on, I know you've had thoughts on the state of the venture market for, we had this scheduled, I don't know, 6 weeks ago or 4 weeks ago or something. And it sounded like you had some thoughts on that. I don't even know if you even recall what those were at the time, but it sounded like there were some Weinberg hot takes that were hanging out there. What's your opinion on like what's going on right now in the market?
I don't actually think I have any like particularly unique opinions or insights into this. I mean, in general, what I think happened in many cases, and this is maybe like a little exasperated in some of the stuff I spend time in, which is healthcare, not just biotech, but like healthcare services, where it's probably one of the worst offenders, is you had a lot of businesses over the last like 7 or 8 years that the margin structure of those businesses does not look like SaaS, but like SaaS multiples were applied essentially from a valuation standpoint. And those are the ones that seem to be the most in trouble, where you look at them and you're like, okay, you know, the actual ability for this business to like produce cash when it, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years from now is still in trouble.
If your gross margins are 8%, it doesn't give you like a lot of wiggle room on EBITDA.
Even like, okay, so like healthcare is the obvious one because you never really get to margins that are that high. And so you have to really think about like, what is the real, you know, contribution margin of these businesses. But even in fintech, I mean, and I invested in some of these companies myself, probably because I didn't like think about it. You know, I got caught in the hype and maybe not as bad as some people, but like, you know, still there. And I've gone back. I've had conversations with these founders and they're like, oh, you know, we've got all this like top line revenue. I'm like, cool. Walk me through like the margin structure on the revenue here. And you start to see like negative margins or 10, 20, 30% because there's like layers of, you know, fees underneath that you can't actually go and get grab for yourself. And you realize like, okay, even like the fintech stuff in many cases is not really like SaaS margins. And so
you throw interest rates on top of this, right, as well. And that makes a lot of things go haywire. It changes a lot of the assumptions. It's interesting. I agree on the fintech and healthcare. Like there were definitely multiples ascribed or assumptions made on like what type of operating leverage could exist. And fintech had this weird thing that a lot of it was very circular, where it was like, oh, it's a fintech company and it sells to some banks, right? But also then it sells to all these other fintech companies. And so it's like, okay, so we're kind of rinsing venture dollars around in this pool over here, which was definitely, I mean, SaaS had the same thing in some ways, right? But there was more. I think there's been more forgiveness in certain ways there. But I think if you look at one of the things I think people forgot, and we were not totally immune from this at all, but there was an old adage when I got into venture that's like, it's really hard to make money in SMB and selling to venture-backed startups, right? And that's like, we should discount that revenue way less than any other revenue within SaaS. And then over time, there's been a bunch of companies that HubSpot or Shopify or whoever who have actually proven SMB, yes, higher churn, recession, definitely more damaging, but they've actually outstripped any of the expectations I possibly could have had for what those businesses were. That said, a lot of people lost sight of like a dollar selling into an enterprise or a non-tech customer was not the same as a dollar selling into a venture-backed customer because of all the money sloshing around in the ecosystem. And we've seen it pretty hard in seat-based pricing, and particularly seat-based pricing and things that are related to go-to-market, sales in some capacity, right? People were pretty liberal in their ambitions around what their licensing would look like. And now as they triage it, because they're venture-backed companies and they're trying to control their numbers, they are cutting back on their seats. And so while these are good companies, the acceleration of the growth that they had over the course of 2020 and 2021, 2022, let alone valuation, like obviously valuation went wacky and people were willing to pay 50, 100 times, but like the assumptions around what with the fundamental atomic unit of growth that they were going around, people really forgot that stuff as well. And it's pretty painful. These are great companies, but it's going to take 2 years or 3 years of these businesses kind of right-sizing their licensing and maybe at zero growth in a lot of ways. Like I've heard real good businesses at scale sell to go-to-market orgs, adding zero because all their net new sales are being offset by all their contraction and churn.
Just overpaid for a bunch of stuff for a lot of years, you know, and that's what's, you know, you're going to get kicked in the face a little bit when you pay up for something at price that's, you know, 4X, 5X, 6X, what it should be. And it's not like there's, it's not like things were fraudulent. It was just overpriced in almost every case.
Overpriced, also, overpriced and under considered on the risk. Like, I never heard someone say, hey, the risk adjusted multiple of this company, because they sell to all venture backed businesses, should be lower than this, or should have a higher risk adjustment than this company that sells to enterprises, right? Which is, would have been the right perspective.
Well, I think, like, you know, a lot of people assumed markets were bigger than they really were. And so, you know, you see these companies that are, they get to like tens of millions in revenue, and then they kind of like top out and they don't grow as fast. And you realize, like, oh, right, that's actually not worth, you know, 20x revenue. It might be worth 2x.
Well, then the other thing is, like, the circular nature of valuation underwriting. I will tell you, no one, and we were victims of this, right? No one was saying, okay, well, you know, the likelihood is all these things trade out at 10 times free cash flow or 20, like at terminal, at end state. There was a lot of, well, if Snowflake is a $50 to $75 billion company, do I think this can be a tenth of Snowflake? Yeah, I think that. And so then you're paying a high price based on what is already a high price, right? And then Snowflake comes down and you're sitting there with like, oh, well, actually, that doesn't work anymore. That totally breaks the valuation framework that you had from the start.
It's also, and like, you gotta remember, like, Snowflake is in one of the largest markets in the world. Like,
top trading software business out there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So maybe like the biggest, thing I've seen that stands out to me, besides like the valuations that are nuts, is just the quality of the ideas that I think entrepreneurs were held to for the last like 6 or 7 years were really shit. You know, it was kind of like every low hanging fruit idea in the world that, you know, maybe you could turn into some like SaaS workflow tool got funded. And so
not just the one, by the way, then the second and third and fourth. And so
yeah, the whole category
economics got fucked up because there were four people going after a $200 million market opportunity. And so all their CAC went up to 60 months or whatever. And so now where do these companies go?
Yeah. And I think there's not a whole class, but there's a set of founders that I think never felt like the pressure on the idea that they probably should have. And then, you know, the quality of the company they ended up starting, or their understanding of what good looks like in terms of like being a founder and the quality of like the strategic thinking and complexity of the actual work you have to do. It's just, they're not up to snuff. Like, there's plenty of founders I've met, even many that, you know, I should say many because that makes me look bad, but like some of the ones that we funded, where I've caught up with the founders, you know, a year and a half, 2 years later. And I'm going like, you kind of suck, actually. Like, you're not cut out for this job. The quality of the thinking is not there. The quality of the work isn't there. And so
what do you hear, by the way, in the quality of thinking that leads you to have this conclusion? Because thinking is such an ethereal thing. Is it just that they're not grokking intuitive concepts?
Yeah, I mean, everything from like, you ask them to think through like the market, not like the bullshit TAM that everybody sticks in a slide, but like the actual addressable market they can go after, the pricing that they're going to go into that market with, how they're going to defend it, like how they think about customer segmentation, the business model side of it, right? Like, who is buying your thing at what price and why? And like the underlying bottoms up version of how you're supposed to build out that model, because that's what drives many of these businesses, it's just not there. Like, oh, we have these like 8, you know, first target customers, and you're like, cool, how many more are there? And they hadn't really asked themselves that question before. They hadn't thought about like the ACVs that they ultimately will need to get to be able to support their actual like sales cost. There was just nobody ever asking like really difficult, detailed questions about the business model. And you see it now when you poke at it a little bit in many of these businesses where, you know, I don't know, their cost structure is crazy. Building into a market has got like $200 million in total top line revenue in the whole segment. Stuff like that. And so I find it when you poke and when you dig into the details. So that definitely for me stands out. And then I also have seen just like many, and particularly the younger founders who don't know how to manage like a small workforce well. Because the way they've always gotten out of problems is they hire more people. So like when you, money is free and you're like, oh, I got this problem. All right, let me like spin up a new team. You know, that doesn't create a lot of rigor in how you actually, you know, get stuff done within the organization. And now when your budgets are constrained and you're forced to actually like make your current workforce better, they don't have the skill set to do it. They don't know how to. They don't know how to interview. They don't know how to hold people accountable. They don't know how to manage the goals because they were never trained on how to do it. So
are you trying, like, how much you guys have, how many people in your portfolio or how many angel investments in totality that are active right now?
From operator, which is everything but biotech. Biotech is all I do through the main business, but probably 250, 300 companies, let's say, over the last 8-9 years.
And do you, if you're having that conversation and reaching that conclusion, are you telling them, like, what counsel are you giving? Or ultimately, is obviously, I don't think saying you suck is a productive conversation to have. But when you have that conversation, or you hear this, are you, as a mostly passive early stage investor, are you encouraging them to maybe tap out and say, hey, you might want to start thinking about a different landing spot for this business?
Yes. I also tell them they suck.
You do.
Yeah, 100%. Because, like, you know, I don't have the patience to, like, you know, what, lipstick on a pig, whatever the phrase is. I just kind of be like, I don't think you're really good at this, or like, here's an issue. Now I try and be more specific of like, you suck at this thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. So it's not just like you suck generally, but you know, you don't, your ability to sit and actually think through like market segmentation and pricing and all that, like, it's terrible. And usually what I'm telling people is like, if you're bad at these things, you need to go find people who are really good at them to teach you. That's usually my advice to almost everybody. It's not just like telling you you're an idiot, because most of them, they're not dumb, right? They just maybe are missing certain skills because they were never trained on it. And so most of what I try and encourage people to do is to surround themselves with really, really sharp people in the areas in which they are the weakest. They may have never heard that they were weak at this thing. And then, so, you know, sometimes I'm the first person saying, you know, your storytelling ability sucks, or your deck looks terrible, whatever. But like, the advice is always to go get better people, and then to teach them a little bit of like how to do it. And then, yeah, sometimes you have to tell the founder, like, look, I don't think this is going to be a $1 billion business. You may want to look to find, you know, an out, or take the deal that was offered at a price you don't love, but the alternative is a zombie business that never gets there. I definitely will give tough love. I try to do it in a way where, you know, 24-year-old me would have appreciated. Some of the best ways I learned back in the day, and remember, like, part of this, I got lucky. I started my first company in 2007. And then the world collapsed in 2008. And so we got some very tough love very young. But we had one or two advisors who would just yell at us, and like in constructive ways, but like not nice. And I really learned very quickly of like what good looks like. I think I might have even told this story before on the podcast. I don't remember, but I remember being in one of the initial sales meetings for Invite Media back in like 2007 or something. And Brian O'Kelly, who was our advisor, and he was basically like me for us back in the day, like semi-successful entrepreneur who like kind of knows what they're doing and it doesn't have a filter. And he would join some of these sales meetings. And I distinctly remember him telling me after like one or two of these meetings, he's like, you are fucking terrible at this. And like, that was very eye-opening for me of like, oh, right. Yeah. Maybe I don't know what I'm doing here. And then he would give advice and like how to get better. But I still hear it. I still hear him telling me that in my head, you know, 14 years later. I know some of the best advice I ever got was just like, you suck at this. And like,
Brian proved to be actually, you know, CEO of AppNexus, which sold for what was the actual acquisition price of
$2 billion. I don't know. He's great. He's a super successful entrepreneur, and he takes no prisoners. And I think in general, the good founders want to know what they're bad at. And it's hard because, you know, for a long time when you were raising money, you know, nobody wanted to tell you something wasn't good because it was so competitive to like get into these deals. And so that feedback loop of like, nah, it's not great. It didn't exist at the scale it should have. Now people are hearing it. I do think people are realizing, I hear it when I talk to founders, they're seeking advice. They want help. It's great. So this is healthy for the market.
One thing you tweeted, I don't know how many months ago it was, but that I wanted to talk to you about was you said, so I'll give a summary of it, but 2013 and later stages, Series B and C, VC will be defined as everyone has money, but no one has chutzpah. In my opinion, this comes from a dynamic of not wanting to be outside the herd. You don't get fired if everyone else sucked alongside you, aka 2019 to 2022, but you do get fired if you're the outlier doing big deals in 2023 while everyone else hides in the quarter, which likely means there's some very good deals out there that are underpriced if you have conviction and no fear. The best investors know this. Question is, can they convince their partnerships to swing? What's interesting that I found, and this is just like a weird thing, the one exception or asterisk I would put on all that is everyone has so much fucking money. And yeah. So there was this thing over the course of 2022 where no one really fundraised because they went in their bunker and they were like, shit, why would we go out right now? We can wait another few months and see if the market turns or whatever. So no one was really fundraising in 2022. Now we're seeing businesses that fundraise in 2023. And it's interesting, in particular with AI, which we can kind of put in a corner and I would love to hear your thoughts on, but even in enterprise software or whatever else, healthcare, I think because these funds are so big and people haven't done deals in a year plus, it's been a while, that there isn't this logical based underwriting that you think you would see. And so what I've actually seen weirdly enough is I've seen some companies caught in the margin, but it seems like there's this conceptual framework that people have of like a low enough in Series B and Series C land where I play, a low enough valuation. And low enough used to be when I started in the industry 10 years ago, it was like 100 million or 75 or 125. And then it crept up to like $1 billion in the peak of 2022. Now it's like gone back down. It's sub 500, I think. It's kind of like 200 to 300-ish. But it's interesting. You hear about these companies that are raising around there and they're getting browbeaten by so many investors that like want to invest at that lowish absolute valuation. Cause even if they're paying 100 times ARR, if they hold it long enough and it's actually a good company, it should find its way. If it's a software business, whatever, all that stuff, it should find its way to being at least a 2x, probably a 3, 4, 5, 6x. If it's a real public company and has that path, right? And so it's interesting. I keep waiting and I don't know when the reckoning's actually going to come. It might be when the funds that are so big have to go back and fundraise and they have so much dry powder right now. And so they're like, oh, fuck it. We'll cross that bridge when we come to it. But it's interesting. I've seen it decline slowly, but it's not like the reason there aren't a lot of rounds in my mind is that there aren't a lot of fundraises going on, right? More than it's that the VCs are timid in it.
The thing with venture in general is it's such a big industry now that like the kind of gross generalizations that you have to make on Twitter, basically, they're just always subsegments where it's not true. What happens in healthcare, different from enterprise infrastructure, from, you know, like each of these categories has gotten so big that like you have a ton of like heterogeneity in all the markets. And so, you know, I see plenty of companies where I look at them and I'm like, I have no idea how you're ever going to get back to this valuation. And then I have the flip of them, some of them where I look at it and I'm like, holy crap, this thing could be massive, but maybe like the numbers aren't there yet and no one's willing to make the bet early. People got like a little more conservative giving forward credit to some of the early companies. As with all of these things, I genuinely believe there's a lot of money. There's a reasonably large number of smart people in this. There's a lot of like effort and hustle. The good stuff will get funded. It will survive. It will work eventually. It may not happen, you know, where the founders own 30, 40% of their own thing anymore. They take some dilutive rounds or down rounds, recaps, whatever. But good ideas will find a home this isn't like 1997 where there's like eight venture funds on one strip in California, right? Like it's so big and it's global. So at this point, if you as a founder in software cannot figure out how to get your thing funded if by just like dropping the price, it probably means the business is like is challenged on its own. It's just, it's big now. It's big. Yeah. Now, from the venture side, like, yes, I understand why you hold back and you don't do the deal on the margin because you don't want to go back to your LPs, right? You don't want to go fundraise. I mean, you can, you know, you read all the little stupid gossip of like Tiger and others struggling to raise their next fund and not by off by like 20% or 30%, but off by like 80% kind of thing. It's funny to me, like what I don't, to take myself out of the founder seat and put it more as like an LP side of things, you know, you go and you talk to LP, as I did for CurieBio, and I talked to many sophisticated LPs. And the thing that I could never get in my head straight was like, they know that the larger the fund, typically, the lower the returns. Like there is an inverse relationship between size of the fund and returns. They all know
that. And deployment of pace of deployment as well, right?
Yeah, like anybody who's been an LP at any sophisticated endowment, family office, whatever, for more than a few years understands this like inverse relationship. And yet, for like 6 or 7 years, they were, you know, joining. I mean, I was an LP in one of the Tiger funds too. Like that was big, not the biggest ones, but some of the recent ones. And we all just got caught up in the hype. Even the smartest people got caught up in the hype and we're in a way kind of like resetting to what I think is a more normal, rational system. Like smaller funds perform better. It's very hard to return a $20 billion mega fund in the private market. Yes, that is not hard. It's not like an easy thing to do when, you know, there's like one outcome every year that can support it. So
I remember we raised a fund in 2021 and everything, we have good returns. And so everything went, you know, it was relatively smooth or as smooth as I ever could have hoped. Right. But the number of times we got asked, like, what? Where do you exist in this world of Tiger, right? Because we were raising $650 million for like a early growth fund. And in the world of like other people having $5, $6, $8 billion funds, and I'll say Tiger, but anyone can do, anyone can Google who else has funds of that size. In the world of all of those folks having so much money, we spent so much time. We had like a battle card of how we win and the explanation of like why we're keeping our funds smaller. In 650, we ended up at 725. Like that is not a small.
It's not a small fund.
It's not small, right? And no. But we had a whole battle card about like, all right, well, here's how it works and all that. And I will say, being on the other side of it now, everyone obviously is so, oh gosh, we love your model so much and whatever, staying small and disciplined and all that stuff. It was funny to have lived. I feel like I've learned more. I joined 2013, 2014 in venture. I joined tech in 2011. I think I learned more 2019, 2020, 2021, 2022. Like in the totality of things I learned, my learning curve was steepest there. Because it's weird. You hear about bubbles and manias and all this stuff. But it's weird to be so trapped in it. And Chris Dixon was like number one on the Midas list for crypto investing, right? Like literally the number one investor in the world for all this. And the number of questions we got about our crypto investing strategy and all of these things, it's interesting to have lived through that whole rise and then the hangover. It's just like an experience I'm never going to forget. And so one of the things that's interesting now with AI, and we can talk a little bit about that, is anytime I've been in this market that we've had to rethink our investment prosecution and investment committee and like how we operate and decision on things, anytime that's been a terrible fucking time to invest in the company that you're required to do it in totality, right? Quite literally, it's a nightmare. And it was true of mobile, and it was true at the peak of SaaS, and it was true in crypto, and it's now true in artificial intelligence. And I actually am a pretty big believer in like artificial intelligence as a economic lifter of society. I'm probably a skeptic of like the near-term equity value that venture-backed companies are going to accumulate in that. But we'll see. I'm at least curious by all the things that are going on in a meaningful way. But when we talk about like having to reorient how we think about valuations and the team is so good, and so we have to back the team rather than look at the metrics. It just sort of, I didn't live through the internet bubble, but I just sort of think of like eyeballs, or I think about like community growth in crypto. And it's weird because like I'm optimistic about artificial intelligence in general. I have some concern about like some of the existential stuff, maybe. I don't know. Smart people seem to have some concern there, but at least as like a societal lift, I think there's a lot there, and it's going to create a lot of like GDP productivity growth, I think. But that doesn't necessarily mean equity value to venture-backed startups. If you go back and look at the internet bubble, and someone's going to correct me on this information, but like what companies created value out of the internet bubble? It was like Amazon, and it was Yahoo, and it was eBay, and it was PayPal. And you like kind of go down the list, and you get to like 5, 6, 7, 8 names, right? And like, if you weren't in Google,
it's never 400 companies.
It's never 400 companies. And there's always like one or two that drive the lion's share of all the growth. And so if we assume OpenAI is one of them, then we're probably talking about a pretty short list of other names. And maybe for those, you pay whatever it is to get into them. But like the spray and pray mindset of like, okay, let's buy these logos it just doesn't totally fit with a bunch of different things that I've at least seen, but we'll see.
We always like, I just have the same thesis to any of these things. And I think it was kind of true of crypto and all the other pieces, which is at the end of the day, what is your product? Who is buying it? What are they paying? What's the substitute product? Why do they pay you more? How many, you know what I mean? Like, it's just a business. And so I think a lot of these AI companies, the way I look at them is like, cool, you're like another enterprise software company. That's great. Let's just go look at it through that lens, right? Like, who are you selling to? What are they willing to pay, and why?
And those are the interesting unlocks, by the way, that I can think of like, hey, I think there's going to be a lot of the enterprise businesses that are public or whatever that are going to be able to increase their gross margin because customer support is going to go down as a percent. And so like some lift in that, or ticket deflection, if your service now like will have some AI, or Adobe will have some AI. And then I think there's going to be a bunch of service oriented or like smallish businesses that you can now do stuff with software that actually can make them venture backed. And so a bunch of people have gone into legal, and like historically legal was just an okay business, but you had to throw a ton of bodies.
By the way, the reason those are so, legal, and I agree, by the way, is really interesting, is because like, it's pretty easy, not easy, but it's reasonable to tie the specific technical innovation in these new large language models, not AI broadly, but like the LLM specifically, to an actual customer problem that these law firms or the customers of the law firms have. And you can see like, oh, right. Okay. Yeah. There used to be like a whole bunch of like paralegals making $60,000 to $150,000 a year who had to like look through a bunch of text data. You know what these LLMs are like really good at? Looking through a bunch of text data. It's like the one thing they're kind of exceptional, not that one, but a thing they're exceptional at. That makes a lot of sense to me. Like, yes, there are probably going to be a bunch of these companies in that space that are successful because we understand the problem. We know exactly where the technology will fit. Seems great. The LLM, they tend to, looks like they're very good at like creating imagery, right? Like you can see it in, you know, both images and then what eventually will be video, which is just kind of like stringing a series of images together, I guess, at its core. Seems like we're probably going to have a few like really big plays there. That would make sense. I think we're going to see a lot of interesting stuff in like meeting recording and meeting summarization. A lot of text. I just kind of go like, you can see it. It's not, you don't have to make these like 4,000 logical leaps in your head about how is this thing going to play out. And that's usually how we look at these, you know, these investments is like, okay, I'm just going to look at it like any other software company. If I understand why you're better and why you're likely to win in the long run, you know, it sounds great. The weird thing about software specifically in these AI companies is like how much it does feel like the incumbents actually have the advantage here. And people have now realized this very quickly, right? But you know, previously, if you wanted to deploy any sort of like complex ML in your business, let's say your State Farm or Verizon, whatever, any of these companies, you had to do like a lot of building in-house, right? And that's part of what was the barrier to entry, was like many of these companies don't have the sophistication to be able to do it. Now you don't. You kind of don't have to do a lot of this stuff in-house. Now we have like service providers. And so, yeah, whether it's Microsoft or Google or one of the big guys now providing, you know, what is like an outsourced ML team to many of the existing companies, all of a sudden you realize like actually the ones with distribution are likely to be the winners.
Distribution leads to data. And if you're sitting on top of these open source models or whatever, or even closed source models, and you're using your own vector database to get your data into those systems, like the hard part of getting customers, the hard part of building a business is getting customers for the most part. And like, especially with how quickly and innovating innovative the platform companies are being from an underpinning standpoint right now, it feels like the ones that are, that have the distribution already are going to be the ones that capture the lion's share of the equity value. Have you talked to Levy at all about this, Aaron?
No, I haven't specifically, although like that's a probably a great example.
To talk to him, I had him on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, and like following his Twitter now is just like, I mean, the guy has not, his wife said he had to stop talking about AI at home. He's like just so excited because they have all this data. And like,
I mean, he's a documents company.
Yeah.
It's like, if there couldn't be a better setup, it's like, you know, hey, you know what we do for people? We store a lot of text data in a variety of formats. Like, it's like the perfect spot.
You know? Who's not going to displace Box is the AI first content repository that wants to sell to the enterprise and goes and, you know, they're 10 years away from hiring a $1 million sales rep to go sell the product, right? And Levy's out here geeking out and doing the whole thing. It's like, you're not going to disrupt Box like that, right?
It's like the best, one of my friends said to me, and I think he's probably right, like the best way to play the like AI revolution as an LP is to just buy the NASDAQ and close your eyes.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's probably right. You know, you don't even have to buy the NASDAQ, to be clear. You could just buy like, you know, the top 10, the Googles and Microsofts and NVIDIAs and Snowflake, whatever, all the ones that are just like clearly poised to win here. Well, and then you don't have to do all the picking.
Well, if you look at like mobile as a category, right? And like what happened with mobile. So Apple and Google created a lot of equity value. There were companies like WhatsApp and Uber and maybe Airbnb or whoever that like rethought Instagram, that rethought something from a mobile first standpoint of like what could be done. That's interesting. You know what B2B CRM was in mobile? It was Salesforce, right? And yes, there were some companies like Service Titan, like in field service management or whatever, that without people having smartphones and mobile apps, you couldn't really do that stuff. And so my analogy to that would be like the legal service business that like distilling down all this practice management stuff. I think that makes sense to me.
By the way, in mobile, if you wanted to make the most money, you should have just bought Apple and Google.
100%, right? That was the lion's share where the value went.
So just buy those two. You're good.
What I think is also interesting though, and I'd be your perspective on this is like, people didn't learn any lessons, it feels like, from crypto at all now that we're in AI. And obviously, you and I have views about the utility of both that are different.
It's hard to compare. I will say, as much as I love the like ability to compare, at least the AI stuff is like pretty awesome technology, applicable, sure. No, you know.
100%.
There's hype stuff.
But. And I don't want to, so that's why I don't want to over extrapolate this is like, there is going, AI is a real thing, 100% a real thing, right? And so in Web3 crypto, I think we both have shared, you more than I, some very public feelings on that. So I don't want to compare the two. That said, there was this period, and we could even use SaaS as an example over the course of the last 3 years. There was this period of irrational exuberance that everyone was operating under and like squinting and speculating on the future. And it was true in crypto and it was true in B2B as well. And it feels like we've learned a lesson. We learned the very specific lesson. The industry did, like, the very specific lesson of, like, oh, that was silly. Like, we shouldn't really value a $75 million revenue company in SaaS at $5 billion. We shouldn't do that. That's dumb. But man, this $2 billion round over here in this AI company is looking pretty good, right? There's probably some meme to come up with it. And I don't know how much is perverse incentives that people just have funds and they can tell the story that this is potentially really exciting versus they genuinely believe that AI is different. Because I think it is different. I don't want to be a total cynic about this stuff, but I think venture is pricing out all the potential returns in the way it's acting. And so maybe it's just this whole prisoner's dilemma thing of all it takes is one to set a market. But it has been super weird to watch from my perspective.
If there was a category that I would feel comfortable like overpaying in, I'm not sure it's the one where I have to like directly compete with Microsoft and Google. That feels tough. Like they have all the resources in the world. And so like those plays, maybe you win because you get super lucky that, you know, Amazon and Facebook or whomever decide like they need to kind of hop ahead and they're essentially like willing to pay whatever it takes for a cash burning, but kind of like when Walmart bought Jet, right? Like Jet on its own is probably bankrupt, but Jet inside of Walmart is actually like a really good business.
Is it, by the way, I actually don't know. Is it a good business within Walmart now?
Well, if you assume that Walmart.com fails without it or isn't nearly as big as it is today, then yes, if it's like Jet on its own, no. But like what it became as a combination of the two. I just like, I wouldn't be overpaying for groups that have to compete with these giant players. And then, you know, if you're like the de novo AI first company, which I do think there'll be quite a few that are really interesting that, you know, there's like some new workflow that you wasn't possible before and now it is. Sure, absolutely. But at the end of the day, that's still going to be like another enterprise software company competing for customers. So like, I don't know. I would have to feel really confident that the underlying AI, A, that the team is like theoretically capable of producing themselves, that isn't commoditized. So there has to be like some little twist that the team has, is so clearly tied to like customers buying faster or with bigger prices or like buying something they never would have bought before. That link would have to be pretty clear for me to go and overpay at these like crazy multiples. They're probably great businesses. I'm not convinced that there's going to be that many like multi-billion dollar plays that you can underwrite the like $600 million at $2 billion post checks for something that was created like 18 months ago. But I don't know. You never know, right? Like maybe it plays out, but
it always sounds smarter to be a cynic than it.
Exactly. No. And I do. There are going to be some very cool, great businesses that are built because of this. Like we're already seeing things. I mean, I even going back now, I feel like a grain shill, but like Grain itself, one of the things that's like really interesting about
the website for people, grain.co.
Grain.co.
A lot of free advertising you're plugging here.
I know. Like when we record the meetings, there is like an AI generated summary and effectively like table of contents. They don't build that in house. I'm sure that I don't actually know how they do. I assume they're using like OpenAI and then like some custom data they feed it on top. And that feels like what's going to happen in many cases. You're going to take some proprietary data set you have. You're going to use some like big model that one of the guys at, you know, the Fortune 2 have built essentially. And there's your like little productivity increase right there. Is that a bunch of standalone companies? I don't know.
Has there been, outside of biotech, is there anything that you've seen in the last couple months, any category or thing that has you excited in particular? Or is it just biotech kind of full-time job operator largely is investing in software businesses?
Yeah, I mean, I spend, you know, most of my time in biotech day to day. And then from like a personal investing standpoint, it's good old classic like enterprise software healthcare. So I do see a lot. That isn't just like in science, let's say. I go back to, are there workflows that are now possible that weren't previously possible, right? Like things you just like couldn't get done because the technology wasn't there. And that's why I like the meeting recording thing in particular, right? Because the idea that you were going to somehow synthesize, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of hours of text or video in any way, shape, or form that was high quality and scalable, there's no chance. It was never going to happen. Now you can't. Now I think it's like reasonable to assume that you could record, you know, every meeting of every person in your company all the time and actually get something useful out of it. So those are really exciting to me because it's truly a use case that is unlocked explicitly by this technology. There's some really cool things happening in biotech related to LLMs and kind of like understanding, think like protein folding, roughly, right? There's lots of subcategories, but there's some really interesting things going on that I think will be really useful in kind of like the next generation of drug development. And there's stuff happening in like healthcare and others that have nothing to do with AI that are always exciting. I don't know. The one area that to me is the coolest, I know literally nothing about, is just in like the Adobe land.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Like, the image and video stuff is cool. That's the one area I've spent time playing around with.
Yeah. It looks awesome. And I don't do anything in that area. I don't know how any of it works. It's all fucking magic to me. The idea that somebody can like draw a picture of a person that even looks like a person is mad. Like, that's just incredible.
The text,
that anyone can
the
do
video
that.
Stuff. Runway is one of them that has come out. It's cool. And I think it's just so fucking cool. And I don't know how you get, it seems far away from like utility, being derived at scale. The one thing that I think super interesting with that, and I assume YouTube and TikTok are going to do it, but like we have infinitely personalized and A/B tested ads within Google, right? And so, let's do all the different permutations of advertising and text that can exist when I do a search, right? And let's like value all that stuff. Well, think about now that you can personalize any video. Zach sees a video and there's a cat in it. Logan sees a video and it's a dog. Zach sees a video and it's a black woman. Logan sees a video and it's an Asian man. And just like all the advertising that can be like on YouTube TV, Nike can spin up. Every video could be personalized to the individual from an advertising standpoint and also from a content standpoint in general. And that's pretty cool that you're going to be able to have like just mass personalized video. Obviously, TikTok's doing it in an algorithmic way, which is interesting in and of itself. But from like a content generation standpoint, I think it's fascinating. And I don't know what the implications of it are, but like people are making, I forget, there's like some Balenciaga version of the All In podcast that was super weird.
But somebody showed me like a never ending AI generated debate between Biden and Trump, where the video and the like the audio, whatever, the text content was completely made up. And it's just them debating like 24/7, 365. So there's some really interesting like entertain. I wonder if in 10 years we look back and we call this whole thing like the great distraction, not because like the tech was distracting, because just like attention. There's literally like endless supply of long tail content that's funny or interesting or cool to look at. It's a little scary.
The chatbots that people are like talking to all the time, right? And yeah. That's where I start to feel old of like, go out, like people need to touch some grass, but
I wonder if there's like a return to brand and quality, because you almost go from like everyone trusted everything on the internet to like the younger generation kind of realize you probably shouldn't trust everything, but like the boomers still don't understand that. So they were like way too trustworthy, to now it's so easy to make shit up that the default is like, there's no way that's real. And that's actually maybe a good thing for us as society. I don't know.
I think about the content aggregators and their ability to verify audio, especially around like Drake had that hit song that went viral that came out with The Weeknd, and it was just totally made up. And they ended up making it with like copyright licensing things. But like Spotify's position now to actually like stamp, this is a Drake and Weeknd song, and the like need for aggregators
verification
that can do these things at scale. It kind of goes back to like, maybe you should just buy Google and Apple and Microsoft and Amazon and call it a day, because these big players are going to accumulate so much value in verifying, Facebook probably as well, what's authentic content, what's total garbage, like copyright infringement, all of that stuff.
Yeah, the trusted, you know, we're back to like, oh, okay, there's utility in like the New York Times. Yeah. And Washington
Walter Mondale
Post.
Actually served some purpose once upon a time.
Yeah. We don't, I mean, I already, and I was, you know, I was in ad tech back before it blew up. Well, not before, but like back in 07, 08, whatever. But now it's much bigger. And already then I was like a little skeptical of things I saw on the internet. Now, almost anytime I see a video or an image, my first reaction is I doubt this is real.
How do you verify? Cause like you can only go to so much source material and figure shit out. That's kind of the thing. And we don't need to go down an RFK rabbit hole here, but like, I just don't have the time to go look at all the fucking studies that he brings up all the time to know that like, I think this person's kind of crazy. It's always weird. The conspiracy theorist in an argument, when everyone's like, debate, you know, why won't anyone come and debate him? It's because in the conversation, if we were having a debate with RFK, yeah, he would be like, what about Pizzagate and like, you know, the COVID trials that happened in the back room where the pedophiles were? And I would be like, I'm not totally sure what you're talking about. I don't believe that. And then I would sound dumb because he could bring this thing up in real time. And I would be like, listen, man, I don't know. That just doesn't sound like a real thing to me, right? And so it's this interesting thing with all these people disseminating information. It's so much work to go to the source material and try to verify it. And so I don't know how you do this. Do you just like go back to trusting media sources that actually report on it? And you're like, hey, it might be wrong, but at least there's people that are giving their best intent around this. And I generally trust journalists that they do a good job, even if occasionally they're going to be wrong.
I do the thing that I think is hard for humans, and I've like slowly learned to do this, and maybe it's a skill I learned having to deal with it in the work life, is like, I kind of wait. I just wait. And I'm like, I wonder if that's real. Let's go see if like a bunch of other people figure out whether that thing is real before I jump to conclusions. And like, you know, everyone has like their friends WhatsApp group or whatever. And I'll, you know, someone will send me a picture of like Biden falling on the stairs because he's old. And I'm like, all right, I don't know. Did that actually happen? Is that a, you know, mashup of when it did happen one time, but now they're like redoing it? I have no idea. And so I just assume it's all comedy and bullshit until I see it kind of like on the front page of multiple verified third party sources. Like even if it's just in one spot, New York Times, whatever, I'm kind of like, maybe it's probably true, but like I'm looking for one other validation point here.
What about like opinions though? Like the Hollywood writer's strike. I was at a party this weekend and someone asked me what my opinion on it was. And I was just like, you know, I don't have one. And they're like, what do you mean you don't have one? And I'm like, I just haven't read that much about it. It's just not in my life. I don't know. It seems like a complex issue. I just don't really care that much about that specifically. And they're like, how could you not care? It's about Hollywood and people getting paid and you work in tech and that's the streaming and the licensing rights. And I'm like, yeah, I don't have time. I don't know. Do you just stay away from actually engaging in some of these things from an opinion standpoint?
Pretty much. I mean, I try and find the things that I think are important to me or to the country in theory, because I find them interesting. And then the other stuff, I'm like, I don't know. And I got to try and find a smart person if I like, I'm trying to figure it out. But yeah, it's really tough. I just hope culture, my only hope is that some point before it goes really haywire, culturally, we all wake up and like our default is to think and just be patient. Like it would just be so, society would be like so much better if the minute you heard something that made you like angry or upset or sometimes excited, whatever, if you were just like, yeah, let's see. It just, even the rest of the day, for all I care, like it'd be so much better. But that's
or just like assume, I know we texted a little bit about this, but like government intentions and like negative externalities that come along with this. And just like assume that most people are probably trying to do a good job. And there's a lot of perverse incentives that end up at play. And I
or it's just, how about just like, hey, it's probably more complicated than I think.
That's right.
Like when, hey, like back,
government
back
is so
in,
stupid. And I'm
back
like,
in COVID days, that's my favorite. Back in COVID days, the original stupid argument I got in with Keith Raboy is of like, there's already a cure for COVID. It's hydroxychloroquine. The scientists are covering up. And it's kind of like, do you really think that's true? That like the entire medical profession just missed this thing? Like maybe, but like probably not. And there's probably some complex reason for like why giving it to a bunch of people in a non-randomized study doesn't give you the answer. But like, we're so quick to just assume that we know better because like everybody else is in it. There's complexity. All of this stuff always, is complicated.
That's always my funny one where like someone has a conspiracy theory and then you just make them walk through how many people would have to be involved in a cover up or how that would even happen.
I'm convinced there can be no conspiracy theory more than like four people.
Yeah, that's right. Like Quaylen, like everyone gossips and talks. And so how would that actually play out? Like quite literally, how would that play out when it gets to like 12 people? Then it starts spiraling and everyone gets in the loop. And so like, how would, and what influences and power would all those people have to actually pull these things off? And like, hey, maybe these are just well-intentioned people that are making decisions that prove to be incorrect or you disagree with, or were whatever, ill-informed in some way. Like that's probably the answer in most of these things, but.
Or how about just like, it's a little more complicated than you think. That doesn't mean, by the way, whoever's talking about it is right. It's just like, I'm sure there's some more nuanced reason of like how we got here. And it's not just like a cover up or, you know, someone that's whatever. It's just life is more complicated than people realize. That's why the one that, and I have to jump, but like the one that always stands out to me is just when people start to get into medicine, because I had to do this. Like I had to be the tech guy who does literally nothing about healthcare, and I had to go and like learn it. And you start to appreciate kind of like why it doesn't operate in the same way that tech does, and why like move fast and break shit doesn't work, and why little signals in the data are not proof, and why like just doing more isn't necessarily a good thing because there's harmful side effects. And like, it's just there's different contexts that you have to kind of like you have to learn the basics of, and then you can have an informed opinion about it. And so, you know, a lot of things I thought were stupid about medicine, either the reimbursement of it or whatever, once I actually sat down and understood them, I was like, oh, okay, maybe I don't fully agree with it, but it's not as dumb as it looks from the outside. Like there's a why behind this. That would be great if you just kind of assumed that somebody like thought about it.
I don't know, man. All big pharma trying to line their pockets at the expense of the American working man. I think that's the big conspiracy that we have going on here.
Yeah, exactly. You know, a longer story for another episode or a day or whatever is like how pharma is vilified in ways that are like actually unproductive and unhealthy for all of us. And while there are like some bad behaviors, it would be really good to like talk about what those specific ones are. Man, could you imagine a world in which like we don't have new drugs? You know how bad that would be for all of us, especially Jews, where like I have every skin condition in the world. You're like, oh, there's a cream for that. There's a pill for that. You know, it's like kind of perfect for us. Like, man, it would be bad. It would be bad. But
thank you. Nice. Thankfully, you're immune. COVID was made for you to be immune. So I,
that's us and the Chinese,
actually. Yeah.
Jews and the Chinese. Yeah.
The two people that were. Yeah.
It's all the Chinese food that the two cultures eat together.
That's right. It's a Christmas Day meal you guys have. You share December 25th, and it immunizes you for the rest of the year.
Honestly, that's probably like the best way to do it. Just like whatever it is, give it on Christmas, and then it will just get to us. Really.
Thanks for doing this. I want to give you next time we'll do operating advice, and I'll do life advice. I'm in the middle of wedding planning right now, and so I have a lot of opinions about that stuff. So we can do operating and life hot takes or something next time.
My best advice is don't have opinions.
Don't have opinions.
Yeah. Oh. Just
inevitably, you have to have opinions, though. No, you have to pick where you have opinions about things, right? It's not having the opinion, or it's not what the opinions are. It's the fact that you have opinions, but then you have to be careful what you have opinions about. So
it's fine. It's fine balance right there. Yeah.
All right, man.
See ya.